Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio. We are excited today to be launching a new segment of our Out to Coop podcast. In addition to our regular weekly check-in with our PA Capital correspondent, Sean Kitchen, we'll be sitting down with activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and some of the region's craft brewers and enthusiasts. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Steve Horn from the Smog Blog to help kick off our expanded podcast. And for those of you who don't know Steve's work, Steve is an Indianapolis, a newly Indianapolis-based, used to be the Wisconsin. I got the Wisconsin shirt on him for it today. Indianapolis-based research fellow for the Smog Blog and a freelance investigative journalist. He previously was a reporter and researcher for the Center for Media and Democracy. In his free time, Steve is crazy enough to be a competitive runner, right? Seriously, a marathoner. This personal best, you got to say it, right? It was of 2 hours, 43 minutes, and 4 seconds. He's a graduate of University of Wisconsin-Madison, majoring in political science and legal studies. His writing has appeared in Al Jazeera America, The Guardian, Vice News, The Nation, Wisconsin Watch, Truthout, Alternet, Nuvo, Isthmus, and elsewhere. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about Steve's recent piece on ExxonMobil. I mean, Steve's been covering this for a while, but look on ExxonMobil's role in the climate denial machine and the ongoing probe into Exxon's role in the climate denial, and especially that the case, the probe that's being led by State Attorney General, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Steve just published his piece back on May 10th called Exxon's Lawyer and Climate Science Probe Has History Helping Big Tobacco and NFL Defend Against Health Claims. So we're going to dig right into that. So Steve, welcome, man. How are you?
Good to be here. I'm wearing a Wisconsin shirt too, so good there.
It started in Wisconsin, right? It's so true. It's so true. And I'm, you know, I'm so psyched that Steve was, if people kind of rewind history a little bit here, about back in the fall, we had Steve out at Kutztown University for a citizen media forum to talk a little bit about, how he kind of got into this work and so on. And so maybe down the road a little bit, we're going to have him back on to talk a little about the nitty gritty of that stuff. Because, you know, Steve, I'm telling you, your work, I'm a huge fan of your work, especially as I was saying, right before we went live, is just, you know, you get down into the nitty gritty of this stuff in ways that you just don't see elsewhere. So, kudos to you, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And it was good to be on campus in the fall, too.
Yeah, that was a blast, right? Especially just that your first thing, you look at which way do I run? That was like the first question.
That was the first question, yeah.
All decked out in your bright yellow, ready to go. I was like, he's dedicated. So, all right. So before we get into your article, which really focuses on, it really kind of gets into this lawyer who's headed Exxon's defense team, or at least they're hiring as part of the probe. Give us a little background, just to remind folks about why Exxon is at the forefront of this and their kind of role in this kind of climate denial machine.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is a crucial background before we can even talk about the next part. And that is that since the fall, before that, it was known that Exxon had funded climate denial. But since the fall, what we've learned from investigative reports, from Inside Climate News, from the LA Times, particularly those two outlets, but others. We actually just dropped a piece ourselves about this. Mm-hmm. It's not only what Exxon denied, which is climate change exists, it's a reality, it's getting worse, but it's that Exxon actually knew the opposite from its own internal research. And that is research that was going on since the 1970s, back at least the 1970s. Some have rewinded the clock even further back to industry knowledge at large. Now to the 1940s, but Exxon itself knew from the 1970s, based on its own internal research that it was proud of, that was it was pioneering at the time, really, this climate change research, that carbon dioxide could warm the planet. So Exxon was at the forefront of this research, knew about it, and then decades, especially starting in the 1990s, and in between then, so in the 1990s, it had started ramping up climate denial funding through think tanks, through various media outlets, and just a concerted effort to deny the climate change, or at least sow seeds of doubt that climate change is real. But in between those decades, Exxon cut back on its funding. So it pumped funding into climate denial, cut back on its funding of climate change research. And so that is seen, that was exhibited in Inside Climate News' reporting. So that is sort of the setup where we're at today that leads into, okay, so this whole thing took place, attorney generals became interested in it, and at the state level in New York in particular, they have a strong racketeering, sort of its own RICO, racketeering influenced and corruption organizations, and they have the Martin Act, in which you can bring this, you know, you can prosecute a company for fraud. And they were under the Martin Act. Right now, there's an investigation to see if Exxon had basically conducted itself as a corrupt and fraudulent organization and defrauded the public.
And this is interesting too. I mean, people should know that, you know, the reason why Exxon knew way back when, right, is they were looking to develop this huge kind of natural gas reserve off Indonesia, right? I mean, off the coast of Indonesia. And so they have, you know, I mean, these oil companies, they hire and they have scientists on their board, not because they're just interested in science in some abstract sense, right? I mean, the scientists are there, one, obviously for, you know, how do you go about best drilling and all this other stuff, but also to help the corporation, right, determine what its long-term costs are, right? So that it was looking into climate change and looking at the long-term projections as an influence on its profit over the long term, right?
Correct. It was two fronts. One was, of course, for drilling. So the LA Times article, the first big one that they put out was, what did Exxon know about the Arctic? Well, one of the reasons they were looking at the Arctic was because they're interested in drilling in the Arctic. They're also interested in studying what are the impacts of carbon dioxide and melting the Arctic for potential drilling in the Arctic. So that's one. There, you know, there's other areas off the, you know, up in Alaska, in the Arctic there, et cetera, in Canada. But so there's, yes, of course, for the drilling and exploration and production aspects of it. There's also for regulatory aspects, for due diligence purposes, the company needed to know, okay, if this is going to be an issue, that is, how bad is this issue of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? So we need to answer that first in order to determine how we prepare ourselves as a company to comply with the potential regulations to come. What they decided was, well, it doesn't, you know, based on their own lobbying efforts, it doesn't really look like there's going to be much regulations. So the due diligence was done. They did realize climate change was real. What they decided, you know, then they lobbied to ensure there was not going to be those regulations. And then what they did after that was, of course, the denial, so that the public would decide that we don't need those regulations, or at least a large enough swath of the public. There were, you know, and buy off politicians, you know, the whole influence peddling operation.
Right. So really what's at the heart of this case is that Exxon had, you know, they were at the cutting edge of climate science because they were looking into developing new resources, and they had the scientists that had already seen that, you know, we know that global warming is real. The scientific consensus came together in the 1970s, and they made a decision at that point to basically move forward and say, hey, let's, you know, it's not going to impact us directly, so let's plow ahead.
Correct. And so that they not only go and plow ahead, and of course that's a big part of it, it wasn't going to impact their business operations, but they also decided, well, it doesn't mean that it, you know, sometime in the future as this problem gets worse, that it won't be an issue. They realize it is an issue, and so they realize we have to sow seeds of doubt in the public mind and also make sure that politicians are friendly to this cause of denial. And so thereafter, we see what we have in place now, maybe not as bad as it used to be, but still many politicians who deny climate change. And we have, you know, a network of think tanks, a network of media outlets, a whole nexus of Exxon and fossil fuel industry funded entities that deny that, you know, at least maybe not directly deny how that climate change is real, but deny that it's, you know, it sort of has evolved now to that, it, you know, there's the Republicans now say, well, I'm not a scientist, or it's, you know, maybe the denial is not as hard, but the point is that over the past two decades, Exxon, to the tune of $31 million that we've tracked, has funded various shades of denial. So that's what gets us into today and the New York Attorney General's office, which is probing not only the extent of what Exxon knew and trying to put a date on exactly when it knew it, but also what did it do? And so we have a pretty good answer on all of that already based on the public record, but you know, an attorney general has powers of subpoena to get at even more direct answers to these questions. And after that, then the attorney general of New York, but also now this is lots of attorney generals across the country, can come forward with potential, the power of a prosecution or of a trial. And so that's sort of where we're at now, is only the investigation phase, but this investigation right. could lead to more.
Right. Excellent. So this is a good place because we're coming up on a break right now. And we come back to that. We got the context now. And, you know, something that you just mentioned about kind of, you know, sowing these seeds of doubt and that kind of connection with the lawyer that Exxon basically hired is really at the focus of the piece that you just published. So we come back after the break. I want to kind of get into that a little bit because, you know, it's not just that Exxon knew. Right. But it actually had a role. And, you know, I'm looking at this case, you know, attorney generals have a direct interest in this because of New York, of course, right, is on the coast. Right. And it's directly going to be impacted by any kind of sea level rise as a result of climate change. So we're going to come back right after this break. This is Raging Chicken Radio. I'm Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And I'm sitting here with Steve Horn. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio. Today, I'm sitting down with Steve Horn as we launch our expanded podcast here at Raging Chicken Radio. And we've been talking about ExxonMobil and its role in the climate denial industry, some of the history behind ExxonMobil's knowledge of climate change, kind of way back in the 1970s and 80s. Steve has just published a piece looking at the lawyer that was hired by ExxonMobil. And I just want to read his opening paragraph. And I want him to kind of unpack a little bit about, you know, why this lawyer, why it matters looking at his lawyer and some of his history and kind of what this means for, you know, this potential probe that's moving forward. So this is what Steve writes at the beginning of his piece. This Ted Wells, an attorney hired by ExxonMobil to represent that company against accusations it lied about climate risks of burning fossil fuels, also represented the tobacco industry in the lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice in 1999 under racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations, the RICO Act. The smog is found. Wells also defended the National Football League, the NFL, in the infamous Deflategate matter, as well as in litigation over the far more serious issue of concussions. All right, so that's a good setup, Steve. So, you know, here's the guy. Like, you know, why does this matter?
So, yeah, Ted Wells is known as one of the most powerful white-collar criminal attorneys in the United States. And his name has really been in the news a lot these days for most people because of what's been happening in the NFL. Not so much with the concussion issue. I don't think as many people know that he was defending the NFL in that class action lawsuit that was brought against the league by players who had suffered concussions, although I think that's a crucial piece of information, which I'll explain in a bit. But he's most in the news today because of his role acting on behalf of the NFL in conducting the investigation against the New England Patriots for deflating, for Tom Brady, for the quarterback of the Patriots, for deflating the football. And the reason why that's relevant for this particular piece is that it's an exhibit of a trend of Ted Wells. And it's pretty much essentially the tobacco playbook, which he actually has tobacco roots. I'll get into why that's important. But looking at the NFL matter, the whole Deflategate issue, when it's actually looked at kind of objectively, we take a 10,000 feet above view, scientists have said that it's very hard to conclusively say that this football was deflated based on physics and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Ted Wells has gone ahead and still brought this lawsuit in this whole thing where now Tom Brady is suspended for four games, and that's all fine and good. But the whole thing that happened here was that science was actually manufactured in this case, in the investigation of something called the Wells Report, in which they hired a third-party contractor named Exponent, and it's been hotly disputed. And that just gets into that's just an example of one thing that Wells was involved in that it was, you know, it's sort of anti-science advocacy, legal advocacy. And that's To get into it a little bit more depth, there's a concussion issue in which, again...
Well, this is number one, this is just incredible just to say that, you know, we know the intricate details of Deflategate, of the football garbage, while you got this concussion thing sitting on the side, and you got the same guy at the center of it. And the idea that, again, I want to underscore that for people, is that this guy... has a history of being connected to these organizations that manufacture science for the purpose of these kind of legal cases. And I would also encourage, please check out Steve's article on this one, because there's a link to that report directly in the Smog Blog piece. So please check it out. So anyways, I didn't interrupt you, but you're just talking about concussions.
Yeah. And so the concussions issue, again, there's pretty definitive scientific proof on the fact that, you know, football, professional football is leading to concussions. Lots of players. Yeah, who would have thought, right? And so it's become a major issue, major class action lawsuit. But one of the more telling pieces, just this will transition well into the tobacco part of this, and this is the most important part. But in that whole episode, the New York Times wrote a big investigation just a couple months ago in which they showed that the NFL was, again, manufacturing science to show that the problem wasn't as bad as it was by fudging reports and that sort of thing. And they also, they went a step beyond that. And I think this is what really upset Ted Wells and his law firm. They did not mention Ted Wells or his law firm, but what they did was said, look, the NFL has been hiring a lot of attorneys and lobbyists who had roots in the tobacco industry to work on this concussion issue. And what happened was Ted Wells' firm wrote, this is very rare, but the firm wrote a response to the New York Times investigation that the NFL published on its website. So they actually publicly responded to this New York Times investigation with a letter that was written by this law firm. Ted Wells' name is not on it, but his law firm's name is. And of course, as I just mentioned, he has been the attorney of record on this concussion issue and on Deflategate. He's very tied to the NFL and legal advocacy. So even if his name wasn't stamped onto that particular letter, Ted Wells was likely involved in some of the stuff behind the scenes, and that gets into tobacco, of course.
This is really interesting too, as well. Just the fact you have a piece like that, it tells you a couple things right off the bat, right? It tells you what they don't want us paying attention to, and they don't want us paying attention to this historical pattern, right? The playbook that you draw attention to in your piece, and the fact that he made a mistake, right? His firm made a mistake here by basically saying, "Hey, I know you didn't mention us, but we're going to jump in on this." So now we've got them in your sights, right? I mean, now we could see, okay, this seems to have touched a nerve, and it goes right back to tobacco.
Exactly. So it goes to tobacco, and of course, this explains where I got in. I got in the front door for me for this investigation was when the New York Attorney General's investigation was launched. Just days later, it was announced that Ted Wells was going to be Exxon's attorney, but didn't really say exactly who Ted Wells was, except for maybe I think the Deflategate connection, but nothing about the tobacco connection. But it didn't take too long of searching for me to see, oh wow, this was the guy who also represented Philip Morris in this lawsuit, this RICO lawsuit at the federal level that was filed by the Department of Justice that took place between 1999 and mid-2000s. So it was almost a half decade thing where he was involved with defending Philip Morris. And so through these many entrances, you can see, you know, Ted Wells is connected to all these different issues. But on the tobacco thing in particular, why is it important? Well, in the case of tobacco, we have a lot of examples that we can actually point to because of the tobacco archives that came out as a result of settlements, the master settlement agreement that the University of California, San Francisco houses. So you can actually go to their website and look up Ted Wells' name, and you can see where, you know, things that he was involved with for those lawsuits. So that's what my piece basically draws.
Well, yeah, and right here, right? This, I got a picture of it right here. This is again, you can just go right to the Smog Blogs piece that Steve wrote, and he's got a link to this stuff. And here you can actually see the files. And in this one in particular, this gets right at the center of, you know, the strategy, right? This whole idea, and I'll read from this. And this is said basically saying, look, we're in a bad spot here with tobacco, right? The science is coming out. The doctors are basically, it's not good for your health. So his main thing here, and you quote this in the piece, but it's to say, doubt is our product since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. Quote, if we are successful in establishing a controversy at the public level, then there is an opportunity to put across the real facts about smoking and health. Doubt is also the limit of our product. Unfortunately, we cannot take a position directly opposing the anti-cigarette forces and say that cigarettes are a contributor to good health. No information that we have supports such claim. And that really gets at, you get to see this as a strategy that is, I mean, you swipe out cigarettes and you put in climate change there, and it's essentially the same strategy.
It's the same strategy, and the sort of the reason why that thing that you just read is so important, this was the centerpiece of the tobacco industry's doubt playbook. But you see in the Exxon documents, they one of the ones that we unearthed from an archive in Canada, you actually see that they, in their own internal stuff, are saying there is no doubt that, you know, that carbon dioxide is causing pollution in the atmosphere. So they're saying the opposite publicly. And that is important in this case, not only because of what we're talking about just in of itself, but going forward, what did Ted Wells say when he's representing the tobacco companies? This is what's in the documents as well. And he said, and it's in my article, and that's that, yes, this was what we did in the past, but we've changed. Our mm-hmm. culture has changed. The entire, now we're with the, you know, we're with the scientific body. And what you see today, which is why it's so.
We're team players now.
Exactly. No,
we hate oil. We hate oil now.
And they are making a concerted effort. I've seen, and other people have noticed, that since the launch of the Inside Climate News investigation and since the launch of the Attorney General's investigation, now there are 17 Attorney Generals that are investigating ExxonMobil nationwide. But we've seen ExxonMobil, they've rehired a climate scientist on their staff. They're talking more about alternative energy. And you can see a concerted effort where you can kind of see where it's going. You can learn from the past of these tobacco documents to see this is very likely the same exact thing that Ted Wells is going to try to argue to water down the potential crimes that ExxonMobil is charged with. And so we're still very, very early in the investigation, but.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, to bring this home to kind of why this matters so much, right, is that, and why the monetary aspect of this is absolutely critical. Like I already mentioned, look, New York is on the coast. A lot of kind of the biggest cities in this country and around the world. I mean, you're talking about whole countries that could potentially go under, not just cities, right? But, you know, the way that I think most people experience like climate change, you're thinking about, okay, here's this challenge that's right in front of us. Like, so for example, this just came out of Think Progress's Climate Progress blog. When you're talking about next month, right, Bay Area voters are going to decide whether or not they're going to pay to adapt to sea level rise, right? So that, you know, they see on the horizon that San Francisco is going to be, the whole Bay Area is going to be negatively impacted by climate change to the point where portions of that city are going to go underwater, right, of that whole area. So now we've got, you know, an issue that's going to go for the borders. Like, do we raise taxes in order to build seawalls and all this intense infrastructure, right? That is essentially a subsidy for ExxonMobil and these other companies that basically knowingly, right, contributed to greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. So, you know, the question is that should the perpetrator, right, should the criminal be the one who pays, right, or are we going to pay? Because in this case, it's not like we have a choice, right? It's not like we have, say, okay, they don't pay, then all is fine and good. They just get off scot-free. No. We're going to be paying the consequences through mass migration, through dislocation, and having to go have these massive infrastructure projects simply to have our cities and our countries and nations across the world survive.
Right, and so it's telling that one of the states that's involved in this investigation, one of the most vocal ones, is the Virgin Islands, because this is an island state that, of course, is at the center of some, it could be of some of the worst consequences of climate change. So that's telling, but also, yeah, at the center of this whole thing is the question of liability and who will pay the cost. Will it be the one who created the havoc that we will see in the future and the one that sowed seeds of doubt, or will it be us? Will it be, you know, the people of the United States? And so that is definitely at the center of what's going on. And I'll just foreshadow a future piece that will come out soon on DSmog. Several law firms, this goes beyond Ted Wells now, but several mm-hmm. big corporate law firms have put out what are called client alerts. And in those client alerts, one of them actually says, on behalf of its clients, it says, one of the things that you should be doing, talking to corporations, one of the things that you should be preparing for is potentially passing the buck to insurance companies on the cost of complying with these investigations. So they're already looking at how can we not pay, not even pay the legal costs of this. So it's not only about the liability costs, it's actually just the simple legal costs of the investigation. They're trying to pass the buck to insurance companies. And so it's a strategy at large where you already see it a little bit in motion with these law firms. And so foreshadowing.
So well, I'll tell you, we'll be looking for that. And I encourage everybody to keep on looking out for Steve's pieces on this stuff and read the Smog blog and please check out all the reporting, because really they've been at the cutting edge of a lot of this investigative work. And you've already mentioned several other news outlets, right? Several other kind of really investigative sites have been integral in getting this information out. But you know what, just want to kind of touch base to that last part there before we take a break and saying, you know, we really, it seems we're faced with, you know, the economic crisis of 2008, except now we're talking about the planet and climate, right? The same issue. We know who crashed the economy. We know what happened there and who bailed out who, right? Those responsible did not pay, right? And now we're faced with a climate crisis, which really the same question is on the table. Are we going to learn from that history? Are we going to hold the people who caused the problem accountable? Or, right, are we going to let another round of these corporations go scot-free, the most profitable corporations in the world, why we foot the bill? That's really the question on the table. We're going to come right back. We're going to get Steve's closing comments. I might even ask him a little bit about the election, because I understand he's getting a little annoyed with some people on Facebook. But we'll be right back. This is Raging Chicken Radio. This is Kevin Mahoney. Let's talk to you in a sec. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio. We're sitting here with Steve Horn, and again, check out Steve's piece. It's over on the Smog blog. He's kind of that whole investigation into Exxon knowing about climate change and then funding the denial industry, and then his latest piece looking at the lawyer who's really at the forefront of defending Exxon and this and some of the history and connections with the tobacco industry, NFL, and the manufacture of science. So please do check that out. We'll have links in the show notes for this, and so please check it out. So Steve, as kind of way to close this out today, you know, looking at a lot of the discussions about the election coming the fall, especially the presidential elections, because we're just freaking batshit crazy for like the presidential election. Like we can't pay attention to anything else that's on the street from us, but somehow we get to the presidential election and then suddenly people are going crazy about it. But, you know, a lot of the debates are, you know, about, you know, Hillary or Bernie, especially on, you know, the progressive or the left side of things. And we've got the Trumpster on the other side. But, you know, there's a lot of people talking about being a single issue voter. We saw this on the Republican side too, with Ted Cruz saying, if no other reason other than the Supreme Court. We see that also now on the Hillary side, you know, like in the Bernie side, the Supreme Court, you know, that as the single issue to vote. But, you know, I keep on coming back to the fact is, okay, yeah, I get why the Supreme Court is absolutely critical and some of these other issues are critical. But, you know, climate, I mean, this is huge, right? And from where I sit, there has not been enough discussion of that so far in the campaign. But so I'm thinking if you can give us just an angle in and your perspective and read on, you know, looking at through the lens of climate, if that was our single issue in here, I mean, how's this election play itself out? Or, you know, what's the lay of the land? Do we see any possibility that we can start scaling some of this rapid climate change back? Or are we just screwed no matter which way we go?
Well, that's, you know, so first of all, I'll start with the Republican Party just because it's the easiest answer. And that is just today, Donald Trump announced his first energy advisor will be, and it's actually a congressman from North Dakota, Kevin Cramer, who is a climate change denier, who is very friendly, North Dakota being the Bakken Shale, very friendly with the fracking industry there. And so we already know which way that's going to go. He's cozying up with oil and gas interests. We see that T. Boone Pickens is now behind him and going to give him, you know, help raise super PAC money. T. Boone Pickens being a major oil and gas player in Oklahoma. We see another Oklahoman, Harold Hamm, who's a billionaire, who was the energy advisor for Romney. We see him backing Trump. So we know, you know, we know exactly which way Trump's campaign is.
Right.
He says he's not with special interests, but that's pretty silly given who's already,
he's pro earthquake, right?
So we know the answer is pretty simple on the, but the answer is a little more complex on the Democratic side of the aisle, because we still have a primary that's ongoing. I would argue that it's not much left. I think that it's pretty clear that Hillary is going to walk away the winner, just the math is on her side with the delegates. And so we're looking at a race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And so it becomes, if you're a single issue voter, both candidates are pretty bad on this issue. Hillary Clinton, of course, people that are fundraising for her bundlers are also oil and gas people. It's probably not going to end up being to the extent of Trump.
You yourself have exposed a bunch of this. I mean, you've written extensively about like Hillary Clinton's connection to the oil and gas industry going back years. I mean, this is not just this campaign season, but this
Is we look at the fund. We look at the Clinton Foundation, which has been sort of off the table in the primary. Bernie hasn't brought it up, but the Clinton Foundation has maintained ties. We look at her State Department, and that had a global shale gas initiative. They helped privatize Mexico's oil and gas industry, et cetera, et cetera. So there's definitely a clear track record of Hillary Clinton is also friendly to the oil and gas industry. But so then it becomes really an issue of, either you back the Green Party and Jill Stein, which I'll be honest, I vote third party and that's fine. But if you're a single issue voter, still most likely it's probably Hillary Clinton by a little bit, only because she's not a climate change denier, and she's more susceptible to pressure than someone like Donald Trump will ever be to the environmental base. It's a base that she needs to win elections, and so that's a key. And I'll say that the whole thing with the Green Party, as of right now, they are not running a race that is going to secure a huge amount of the vote. They have the same exact woman running as 2012, right, which I'm pretty angry about for other reasons. I just think they should have chosen someone else to garner more public support and more interest in the Green Party. So they have their own issues. So the bottom line is, it's going to, in the mainstream world of voting, it's going to be a race between Hillary Clinton and Trump. Then becomes an issue, really, honestly, just an issue of lesser evilism, because both are pretty not up to par with the scope of the issue on climate change, unfortunately. But I would say that Hillary Clinton is more susceptible to grassroots pressure.
The pressure, right? I think that's critical. And we talked a little bit about this on the break when, Sam Cedar has been talking about this in the Majority Report quite a bit, and is talking about how, the real question is what kind of scenario is going to be best for social movements, right? And the fact is, if you got a Democrat in the White House, right, and she has enough coattails to actually turn the Senate, right, that's a better ground to push things forward. That doesn't mean she's progressive, right? It means exactly what you said, right? It means that she's more susceptible to pressure because the Democratic Party at least gives lip service, right, to those issues that are important to their base, right? And especially climate is again with the forefront of it. So really, I think the challenges for progressives, for activists, for people who care about these issues right now, is to not do what they did back in 2008.
Correct.
Do not just go back home. It's like the day after the election is the day to start the pressure campaigns.
Right? Exactly.
We've already seen what Bernie has done to the Hillary Clinton campaign already, because there's no way she was talking about income inequality. There was no way she was kind of just last, a couple days ago, right, talking about extending out the Medicare, right, the buy-in to Medicare. No way she was going there had it not been for Bernie Sanders, right? And now it's up to us, I think, to actually kind of, to basically just keep the pressure on and not go home this time around. And, frankly, look, we're running out of time. When it comes to the issues of climate, we're running out of time. And I think that we got to have that front and center. So,
yeah. And I think the last thing I'll say is that the most interesting thing about the Bernie Sanders campaign and potential movement that comes out of it is that it's a lot of people who were not necessarily very involved in politics to the extent that they are now today. And I think that I'm a little concerned that people will be disenchanted if he does not end up running and will just go home and say, I'm just not going to vote. But not only not vote, I'm concerned that they're not going to be involved in democracy after that. They're not going to be active in their communities. And so I think that people have to see, we really elevated this guy who people thought had no chance. We really elevated this guy to a viable contender as a president. Look at the power we have. I think people need to realize that power and start building movements off of in community by community where he's been running for office. I think that's what's going to be key going forward, is what does this Bernie Sanders campaign, the people who are involved in the campaign, where do they go from here, and how does it evolve into social movements.
I agree. You know, and there was a piece in Bloomberg not too long ago, was an interview with some of the Occupy Wall Street activists. You know, some of the really kind of hardened activists who actually who've been staying with the issue of income inequality have been organizing ever since Occupy Wall Street. As much as the mainstream media would like us to say that everyone from Occupy went away, these are, you know, folks who have continued to organize. And what I love, the way that, I can't remember the woman's name who was interviewed as kind of one of these kind of leading activists, was saying, like, look, Bernie's one of us, right? We're not following Bernie, right? Bernie is kind of one of us where to move forward. And her point was kind of like our movement is separate from that. That is kind of like a blip in the presidential election, right? Our timeline is different. Our timeline is the daily organizing on the ground. And we're not going to be interrupted just because there's a presidential election, right? And if anything, you know, her argument was that this is an opportunity to kind of energize even more activists to kind of move it forward. And I'm with you, man. I hope people just really are up for the challenge and are not going to go away, because we need folks on the ground.
Absolutely.
So, Steve, man, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always great talking to you. We're going to have you back on again, too, as well, some more of this stuff comes out, because, you know, like I said, your work is fantastic. Please go check him out on DeSmog Blog. We'll have links in the show notes. And, you know, not just Steve's work, but read everything over there on DeSmog Blog and some of the kind of other outlets that he's mentioned today. Again, we'll get some links in there, because we all need to get up to speed on this and get ready to go to battle in the fall. All right. So this is Raging Chicken Radio. Steve, take it easy, man. Talk to you soon.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're out.